So these are the is the rough outline of sort of what I'm planning. Unlike Steve's talk, I don't think I want to put an arbitrary upper limit on the amount of minutes I want to spend on these, roughly 10 minutes each, but there's an upper bound probably of 20 minutes on each. So we'll see where we get. So I'll start indeed with motivation. This is supposed to be sort of a discussion rather than a seminar. So in principle, things can get started as soon as I talk about this motivation part. It's a little bit surprising at some point, at some level, that at a program on string phenomenology, I actually feel that I need to motivate why I want to do string phenomenology. But it would actually be clearly be useful if somehow, indeed, we would be able to look at an approach where we can actually define a limit of string theory, and the particular limit that I'll be talking about is more like a decoupling limit of string theory, which is actually the standard model. And obviously one of the criticisms that string theory has is that it doesn't satisfy what you could call a correspondence principle, which any good theory actually should have, where it incorporates all the benefits of the previous theory and adds more on top of it. And at some level, we all believe that there's a limit of string theory, that is the standard model. But rather than taking that for granted, we want to be able to at least be able to point to a particular construction that would actually do the job. And D-brains at singularities seem like a very useful approach and an adaptive approach to doing this. And this is what I'll be talking about. So I'll be talking about D-brains at singularities. Obviously, a lot of discussion on string phenomenology has been going via the landscape. And the landscape, I'm essentially using it. And it's very it's a very useful thing, the landscape. And my best analogy is that the landscape is about as useful as a garbage can, which is actually being generous to the landscape, because a garbage can is one of the most useful things you can have in your... so we can see if that's going to work for us here. And so basically, just to sort of, first of all, give a motivation, I think that, again, D-brains at singularities are a good starting point for trying to get the standard model via a decoupling limit. And what I mean by a decoupling limit is that one takes the field theory on the brains in terms of the open strings on the brains, and one would like to see if the range of field theories that we can obtain on brains at low energies, while including the general concept of putting them in curved backgrounds, is a large enough space to make realistic theories. Now, one of the reactions typically of a string theorist to any specific construction of the standard model or something that aims towards the standard model is a reaction of indifference, because basically, why do this and not do that? So let me make a few conjectures or statements that I think are valid, at least as a perspective on this. On the one hand, I think, again, this might yield a way of approaching the standard model as a limit, but okay, fine, so what? I think it's actually going to be useful if that can be done. But let me also point to another aspect of this approach, which I think is that it has a certain universality in the following sense, that take any string theory, so any string solution to the string equations, a motion point in the landscape, if you like, with a gauge hierarchy. And let's assume, indeed, that the low-energy gauge theory will look not necessarily like the standard model, but something in the same ballpark, whatever. It's some gauge theory. So what that means is that I could take this theory and do the low-energy effective theory of that string theory, and I'll just take suppose I take just the low energy effective field theory. So I take some UV cutoff on this quantum field theory, and it encodes all the information about the string compactification up to a certain scale, and beyond that, stringy stuff or higher dimensional stuff sets in. Now, if I would succeed in making this low energy quantum field theory on D-brains in a singularity, at a Calabi-Yau, say, suppose I would do that, what I mean by the gauge hierarchy is that as the Planck scale, which is much, much bigger than some TEV scale, which is the scale of where the gauge dynamics takes place. So there's a huge energy range between the Planck scale and the TEV scale, or maybe something lower than this, where I can basically use effective field theory, and it's more around here where the higher dimensional or the stringy physics takes place.
Which Planck scale or type?
let's make it a theory. That's actually a good question. Where the string scale is very much higher than the TEV scale. So what I mean by that is there's a large energy range where essentially 4D effective field theory applies.
This may not be relevant yet, but it might be later. When you say this low energy QFT coming from D-brains and CY, do you really want to say there's a strict decoupling limit where you hold some lambda fixed and take n string to infinity? Or are you going to need more data than such a strict decoupling limit would allow you?
Okay, maybe I'm going to be somewhat... Okay, not a strict decoupling limit. Obviously, the decoupling limit will have some cutoff, but of course the quantum field theory has some cutoff. So some imperfections over here, which go into imperfections over there.
Keep some features of global geometry.
I keep some features of global geometry and allow rather general type of boundary conditions, whatever. I do whatever I need to do here in order to make that dictionary. So gravity, I'm cutting off. So the things I'm cutting off is gravity, Planck scale physics, string scale physics, and higher dimensional physics. Those things, suppose that there isn't some huge range where all those things are being cut off, then the hypothesis clearly, and which I think it's a valid, at least it's a reasonable hypothesis, and if we want to claim that it would not be possible, then that actually would be a strong claim, is that there's a huge class of these theories that actually can be obtained in this way, and maybe actually all reasonable theories can be obtained as such a limit, at least as an effective field theory. Now, the question is now, what does this mean? So I have some Calabi-Yau geometry, which typically will be some cutoff version of a singularity. That's Shami's question, is I don't want to take a decoupling limit where literally this would be like, say, an ADS space, which really has an asymptotic boundary. I don't necessarily require the existence of a UV limit. But then if this is some Calabi-Yau geometry, or it could be some generalized Calabi-Yau geometry, most likely, in fact, with some D-brains on it, then, okay, now comes my use of the landscape as a garbage can, is where I basically say, okay, well, there's not a lot of ignorance that sits here in terms of what would be the UV completion, but I'm just going to assume that my landscape is actually big enough that I can find some kind of UV completion here, although that's an interesting question, what kind of predictions one would want to extract from it. But since essentially I started assuming that it's a point in the landscape, it might be a good assumption that I can find some kind of UV completion of this theory. So now the question is, okay, well, this... Yes?
So you want to take the point of view that possibly all realistic things fall into this category, did you say?
Let's say this way. The question is if you want to find low-energy field theories, realistic, semi-realistic quantum field theories, and you would want to claim that they cannot be constructed from here, that would be the counterexample to my assumption. Well, but my assumption is that I can make this dictionary.
Well, for example, if you're on the heterotic side, it may be dual to this, but does it necessarily have a limit like this where you decouple?
I'm not taking a limit in the sense that I don't take a strict decoupling limit. I'm taking the decoupling limit to this particular scale. So basically, any physics that takes place down here up to that energy scale, I'm trying to reproduce that that same effective field theory.
Do you think you'll have such a picture, say, in some dual?
I think there's probably for a heterodox string theory, one should be able to do this as well. I don't think there's, at the moment, convincing arguments that certain things cannot be done in this setting that would be able, at least I don't think there are convincing arguments that certain field theories, it's hard to do certain things, right? Indeed, SO10 with grand unified theory is sort of hard, it's hard to do here, but it's an interesting challenge to try and do it, and especially, how should I say, even if you include the symmetry breaking at low energies, the quantum field theories that are standard model-like are actually also very D-brain-like.
So at the end of the day, you would actually like to fit all the, 17 parameters to their measured values or better?
By the way, at this point, I can do it since I have tunable Clavier couplings. I'm putting things in the garbage can, namely the question of how to fix them at those particular values. I'll give that to you, you guys as a problem to solve. Here I can continuously tune the couplings. So this is an open set. It's a continuous set of theories. It's not a discrete set of points. It's a continuous set of theories that I can make in this particular way. And the question is the standard model one of the points in that continuous set of parameter family of theories?
But you're sort of going to finesse supersymmetry breaking and moduli stabilization and all that.
Supersymmetry breaking obviously will have to be part of this particular story, but moduli stabilization, right. I'll postpone that question.
But that means you might have moduli in your extra moduli in your line.
No, the low energy, the moduli would be either, I would call them open string moduli, or the closed string moduli, at least the things that are non-normalizable modes. Here, I can tune them. Those are my dials that I can tune. And it's the embedding, the compact embedding, that would fix them at particular values. Yes?
I want to ask how generous your garbage bin has to be. in the following sense, I mean, there are some problems that model builders would say we should explain using low-energy Weber ideas. For instance, the electron Yukawa coupling is very small. Maybe there's a good extra-dimensional way to explain that. Now, if your garbage bin has a tunable coupling, do you want to require it naturally exponentially small, or just say my garbage bin lets me put it to 10 to the minus 10 and that's all?
Okay, so my garbage bin, first of all, I would say I use observation to or whatever. I get boundary conditions here that are dictated by this particular setup, and they might be unnatural in this particular setup. And by the way, so if we take this particular picture of the landscape, at least as some dense set of points on some big space of string theories, where each of these are certain weakly coupled limits of string theory, then most likely a given point in the landscape sits somewhere in the middle, which means the following, is that in any given question that you ask, there may be very different types of questions that you ask about the theory. One is cosmology, the other is what is the Clavier manifold, the other one is what is the low energy effective field theory, and there may be other energy dependent or questions, each of which may have different preferred descriptions in each of these corner points. And probably none of these corner points is going to give you a complete picture of the whole compactification. That's very likely.
You're making an assumption of low energy in all of
this. Not necessarily. I would say if assuming that I can do this, soup up this particular framework to not Clavier but maybe non-supersymmetric singularities that has supersymmetry higher up, I would include that here in this framework as well.
In other words, in this framework, these questions have a low energy solution, they have to be low energy in a different mode or something. It seems like you're going, I mean, if this cone is the standard model sector.
It's not, yeah, it's a standard model sector.
And the height is roughly mapping the energy scale. That means any of these low energy definitions you want about any of these low energy solutions to the texture becomes you want as a push out of this picture. And you're demanding it's set mysteriously by Planck physics. Or by some other
useful question. Or you can choose to build them in, but then
that's... No, right. So I'm not saying that this particular picture will have all the explanatory power, certainly not of grand unified or heterodox string. There may be explanatory power there, but what I'm saying is that... So most likely, if I started from a heterodox string compactification, which... a given one, and I would go through this thing, most likely I have some very awkward compactive perspective, strongly coupled perspective on that particular compactification from this region. But if I start from a heterotic string compactification and I would go essentially, and this is what I would want to sort of conjecture, is that there is some duality, some dual perspective here. Okay, if this is the heterotic string, I take this point here, I might sort of insist on describing it from this perspective, which means that most of the physics would be very strongly coupled from this perspective, but I claim that most likely all of that strongly coupled physics sits up here. Let's say this way, if it would not sit up there, then it would be very strange to assume that...
No.
What is your conclusion?
That this framework is in general.
Even the massless matter would involve the strongly coupled.
Okay, so I agree with you. Let me say the following. So if you tell me that this framework is not general enough, then your conclusion was then I would not be able to make a given field theory by this setup. But you shouldn't tell me afterwards, if I succeed in determining a particular field theory via this setup, that there are probably many other ways of doing it which are equal. Probably there are many other ways of doing it, but the fact that the construction is not unique, I would say the construction has a certain uniqueness in it, that there's a one-to-one correspondence between parameters here and that particular geometry. And this particular description is going to be a given dual description to the one that I started with. So I will, if I would be able to find that point in the landscape, that point is probably uniquely fixed by this particular low energy field theory. Otherwise, you would tell me that if I have a low energy field theory that is completely the same between this setup and that setup, that given low energy field theory, which is numerically exactly the same, would have two different UV completions. Unification, again, I agree that explanatory power from unification would probably not look very, at least I don't know how to naturally include it in this particular setup.
If you have a seven brain there, this picture could be literally right. And it doesn't even have to stretch. I mean, you just need some two transfers.
Yeah, you mean here, the seven brain going up here?
Well, I'm just saying it leads to, unification means that, you know, you extrapolate all the way up to the guess scale, so that's somewhere close to the top in your picture, right?
That's right. But for now, at least, my focus is going to be more on the lower energy range. But, yes?
So when do you declare victory? What is...
No, a victory... I don't think about this in terms of victory or loss. I think, actually, again, if we would have a framework in which we can say, okay, well, here we have adaptable parameters, which in this case we have, within that realm of adapting, at least within that construction, there's a point which is the standard model.
But the standard model, what is your definition of the standard model in this framework? So what type of properties of the standard model do you want to reproduce?
All 19 couplings up to tunability.
On all 19 couplings up to tunability and a spectrum that sort of roughly looks like the standard
that
model.
You have
that looks like the standard model.
Symmetry breaking.
In principle, all that should be in there, but of course, it's a step by step process. So the question is, how close can one get? But the advantage, as I said, of this particular approach is that again, because of it, basically, it's motivated by ADS QCD or ADS CFT, or in general, the notion of that D brains have world volume theories that sort of have a limit, which is quantum field theory. I'm trying to make that particular geometric dictionary, and it's a useful piece of information if we want to know more about the geometry up here.
So in this picture, let's say I have two different literally effective field theories where the parameters are numerically different but within experimental precision of each other. Would you claim that, current experimental precision, would you claim that also you should only really have one description at a higher, in the full string theory?
No, clearly, at least, how should I say, there can be distinctions at higher energies that definitely will lead to different theories. Mm-hmm. But indeed, typically those things would indeed show up as effects already differences at lower energies. And actually, one of the things I'll be pointing to is that, for example, there's going to be a particular prediction of this particular setup that indeed might even contradict, at some level, the naive extrapolation that I'm trying to do here, because there's sort of seems to be a universal prediction of this setup, which is slightly surprising given that grand unification doesn't quite seem part of the story, but it does lead to monopoles typically. So that I hope to get to that point. Yes.
So is a necessary part of this picture that this geometry has a strong warping? It looked like that's what you were essentially alluding to, although you didn't quite exactly say that the hierarchy is related to some.
Yeah, whether I call it warping or not, but basically it's true that what I think about basically this region here, the fact that I'm drawing it as a geometric singularity, what I mean by this, it's the lower energy field theory, say, below some safe cutoff on the D-brains.
Well, in particular, you were alluding to, you know, going up is going up in energy.
That's right. So I'm thinking about this direction essentially, indeed, as an RG direction, which typically happens indeed with D-brains. And to what extent this is a weakly or a strongly curved region obviously depends on the theory. Most likely it's very highly curved, and that's why singularities are a good setup.
If that's how you want to generate the hierarchy, you have to have a big relative warp factor.
Yeah, for me at least, this hierarchy is almost synonymous with warp factors, at least in the D-brain setting. In the sense that if I would take the if I integrate out the quantum field theory on the brain, that integrating out procedure actually builds the new horizon geometry of the D-brains in such a way that precisely the scale factor will scale along with the energy scale.
In that way, then you don't say that because you lower the too much in the unification.
Yeah, so the perspective right now is basically to postpone unification as a property that's manifest from the point of view of the brain theory. So in that respect, it's a low energy perspective. But anyway, I deliberately put a time cut off on that motivation part because I knew that we could continue talking about this. And since I'm in charge, I can stop it. So let's just get to sort of more technical stuff here. So the basic ingredients are very similar to what a lot of other people have been doing that try to obtain standard model-like theory from D-brains. I've given you my motivation why I think D-brains are useful, because of a bottom-up perspective. But the type of D-brains that I would have to deal with are actually somewhat less explicitly controllable than the ones that people are dealing with in the context of toroidal compactification. I consider that sort of one step towards realism because it's very likely that if we want to scan a sufficiently large part of the space of field theories, that we have to go to curved geometries. So when I put a D-brain on a singularity, it typically will do something a bit more complicated than just being a flat D-brain. It will form a fractional brain. And the fractional brain, I should say, has many ways of, or at least different ways of extracting information about what it is. The most controlled way, which only works in a subset of examples, would be to take a D-brain near an orbifold singularity, and there you know specific rules for how to construct the field theory on the D-brain, and then you discover that essentially the D-brain sort of splits up into different subunits. But then one can actually develop a geometric perspective on what happens, and I'll be just talking in terms of that geometric perspective, although that geometric perspective, strictly speaking, has its limitation in terms of its validity when the singularity becomes too highly curved. But there are cross-checks between the orbifold picture and the geometric picture that will allow me to extract a lot of information about, first of all, the field content of the gauge theory and the superpotential of the gauge theory from that particular dictionary, other quantities like the Kähler form, the Kähler potential, or other sort of less protected quantities are much less under control in this highly curved setting. But the fractional brain, what essentially it is, was there a question?
The cross-checks come because the singularity is going to be partially resolved or default or something?
Right, so let's say this way. If there are orbifold singularities that sit somewhere in a moduli space of a more general class of orbifold points within a more general class of singularities, then you can recover the information of the queer theory of the orbifold from this geometric perspective.
This is true for the dot
metzos. This is actually how I came to think about dot metzos. I would not have easily just considered dot metzos, but it came via by thinking about deformations of orbifold singularities. A fractional brain is a bound state. Since I'm going to work in 2B string theory, the basic point, I should also say much more about actually what a Calabi-Yau singularity is. It's part of the ingredients. Essentially, my perspective on a Calabi-Yau singularity is rather simple-minded. I think about a Calabi-Yau singularity essentially as a cone. There's a radial direction, which has to be a complex direction because it's sort of supersymmetric, Calabi-Yau. So there's C over here. And then there's some base of the singularity, which typically we will call X, and the whole space we'll call Y. And actually, the whole space, including the complexification that might also be included, we call Y. And X, indeed, might be a dot Petzo surface, but it's a four-dimensional or complex two-dimensional dimensional surface. So I could sort of draw it like that. And it will have its own topology. It will have, of course, it's the Petzo surface, or this base X in general itself, is a four cycle. And then there are a bunch of two cycles. And I can wrap brains around those. And so these bound states are going to be brains that wrap that base. So all the brains that I'll be talking about actually will live in this bottom here, because that will allow me to think more cleanly in terms of a decoupling limit. And most of the technology, I should say, involves brains which are treated as probe brains, so the geometry will back react on the type of field theory, will determine the field theory on the brains, but ADS-CFT will already tell us that there's a very intricate relationship between the theory on the brains and the geometry. But for now, it's the geometry that will dictate what will happen to the brains. And one of the things that it will dictate is that it will tell us rather precisely, given the shape of the singularity, which type of bound states are actually exist and which are supersymmetric.
You're assuming there are no three cycles?
I assume there are no three cycles, right.
And that's just an assumption?
It is an assumption, but it's actually a rather convenient one. If there would be three cycles, it would lead to certain gauge theory phenomena. Actually, there will be certain interesting three cycles, not quite three cycles, in the game later on. They'll lead to monopoles and things like that, because they lead to point particle excitations in type 2B string theory. In this case, I can make world brains. So let's first think about the world brains in this theory. That's on which the field theory lives. So those are space-filling brains, and if they wrap four cycles, two cycles, or zero cycles within the Del Pezzo, those world brains will be D7 brains, D5 brains, or D3 brains. And each of these will have a certain winding number, and a combination of those winding numbers will give me the charge vector of a fractional brain. So there's a quantity called the rank. Because essentially these things are, and I think Joe explained this last Friday, these are Grothendieck groups of coherent sheaves. These are highly sophisticated mathematical quantities which have certain properties, but we'll just denote them by D7, D5, and D3 brain winding numbers. And so again, in the mathematical language, this would be the first turn class of that particular fractional brain, which is some sheaf. But I'm going to be, again, more simple-minded here. I'll just put a bunch of integers there, which will tell me how many winding numbers there are around the various two cycles. let me denote the two cycles by alpha sub A. So there are a bunch of integers P sub A. And there's a number Q, which will tell me the three-brain charge. And I can be rather quick, short about this. So from the gauge theory perspective, if I would look at one of these fractional brains, it would actually be some seven-dimensional gauge theory that lives on the seven-brain, a UR gauge theory, given where R is the rank. It would have some magnetic fluxes through various cycles. It would have an instanton number, all in terms of the internal dimensions. But if this particular combination of fractional discharges occurs with multiplicity 1, then I would just have a U1 theory in principle on the world 3 plus 1 dimensional world volume. So these are this is the charge vector. So I'll have a bunch of fractional brains, which I'll denote by, say, F sub S. And S will label actually the full basis of fractional brains. And the full basis of fractional brains simply runs over the full cohomology basis of this X. So if there are a bunch of two cycles, so if there are N two cycles, let's make it N plus 1, two cycles. If I take a Del Pezzo surface, which is DPN, it will have N plus 1, two cycles. Then the full cohomology of that N Del Pezzo surface will be N plus 3 dimensional, because I have 1 4 cycle, N plus 1, two cycles, and 1 0 cycle. And indeed, there will be N plus 3 types of fractional brains. So the fractional brains will form a complete basis of the cohomology of, or the homology, if you like, of this base.
Can you tell me quickly, what's a fractional brain?
It's a bound state of these of the 75 and the three brains. It's a particular bound state. And basically, these numbers here, mathematicians can compute them for you based on stability requirements of these particular mathematical objects that represent these brains. Basically, what a brain is, it's some codimension manifold, although in this case, actually, it wraps the whole thing. But again, the codimension properties associated with cycles, and those properties would have to be balanced in an appropriate way, essentially requiring supersymmetry of the corresponding gauge theory. And when you do that, then you get a stable set of brains. And so these are not numbers that you can arbitrarily choose. They have to be determined by the geometry and by stability requirements. But once you have a given geometry, I should say that whenever you have a surface, then that thing can have a shape and a size. Typically, these fractional brains maintain their stability if you change the shape, which is a complex structure. But if you change the Kähler data, the volume of various cycles, different bases of fractional brains may become unstable and they may reorganize themselves. So typically, a singularity comes with a certain list of fractional brains. It turns out that from the point of view of the gauge theory, what will happen is that once you've constructed a gauge theory that can live for a certain shape of the Calabi-Yau singularity, you can start then deforming it. And what will happen is that the gauge theory couplings will change value, and some gauge theory couplings will become strong. And you may have to apply a Seiberg duality in order to have the weakly coupled description of the corresponding theory. That Seiberg duality is a rearrangement of the basis factor of the fractional brains.
Did you say that these are closely related to an orbifold construction? In which case?
Let's say this. Well, this is a generalization of the orbifold construction. In many cases, you'll find in your moduli space a point which is an orbifold, and you get the fractional brains from
in the
usual way.
So the conditions on them are the familiar ones?
Right.
Yes, sir. Do you actually mean
cyber-duality,
or do you mean some
neutron
changes the sign and you condense some things and occasionally
it's cyber-duality? Okay. Are there dualities that Seiberg doesn't claim to have discovered?
Herman, you're being recorded.
I was talking in the context of gauge theories, and I think he actually.
But my question is serious. I mean, do you really mean it's dual, or that you vary parameters?
there are two different things that can happen. I'm just asking that.
What are the two different things? I'm sorry.
One is you have two different theories whose infrared physics is the same. The other is you have a one-parameter family of theories with different infrared physics.
I would say, obviously, the infrared physics in this case is the same.
Okay.
I would say. Although, I would think so.
That's what various papers studying this phenomenon have demonstrated. I don't remember the hypothesis exactly. But.
Okay, good. Yeah, and it goes back to a paper of Dave. Dave is one of the early people to point this out.
There's one author of them.
So they're experts in the audience that know more about this stuff than I do. And indeed, by the way, again, obviously this study, I should mention this, for me, in terms of thinking about the Del Pesto singularities, came from studying a paper of David Bierenstein with Lee, Rob Lee, and Djajala, where they looked at a particular orbifold theory that looked rather intriguing. And I was interested, at least in connection with reproducing standard model-like features, and I was interested in the deformation space of that particular singularity, and it turned out that the deformation space was the space of Del Pesto 8 singularities in that particular case. And the way we discovered that was precisely by matching actually the Kriver data rather than actually knowing that it was a limit of it. Sometimes these Krivers are a quicker way of knowing whether things are related. And actually, computing the Kriver is very easy because basically once you have the wrapping number of these quantities, then what you do is you essentially assign certain multiplicities to the various D-brains. So each of these will have a multiplicity n sub s, which will tell me what the gauge group is, the rank of the gauge group is associated with that particular fractional brain. And then the other thing that you want to know is what is the matter content of this theory, and that simply comes from intersection numbers between the brains. So there's an intersection number between a brain Fi and a brain Fj, and the this intersection number is the you can compute it rather directly, basically as one particular winding number around the canonical class, which is a particular two-cycle dual to the four-cycle, and you take the intersection between the four-cycle numbers and the two-cycle class. Anyway, it gives you certain numbers. So the next thing you do, if indeed you're interested in making theories that look interesting connected with phenomenology, you go and construct some particular examples that might look realistic. So this is sort of as far as I'll go in terms of the technical aspects of what goes into this. If you want to read more about it, people like Mike Douglas, David, the two Davids, and many people have contributed to the development of how to extract gauge theory information from brains on singularities. And my own limited contribution here is to simply look at what people had done and just see what kind of interesting classes of examples one could extract from this. So basically, once you have extracted the rules for how to make a gauge theory that represents the world volume theory of these D-brains, you can see if the standard model will actually fit within those set of rules. So the Kriver rules, as I indicated already, essentially it's just a pictorial way of thinking about gauge theories, where you associate gauge groups with various nodes in a diagram. And this could be a UN node, which indeed happens in non-oriented constructions, but you can also have non-oriented constructions, in which case you can have SPN or SON gauge groups. And then indeed you have more than one gauge group, of course, because you have various fractional brains, N1 and N2. And then there are lines between them, which are bifundamental charged matter, which is N1, N2 bar. And the number of those lines is given by that particular intersection number. And what you now can do is indeed to see if with these rules, with these particular ingredients, you can draw something that looks like the standard model.
But these are, I mean, you can generalize this for the unoriented things, right?
Yeah, you can generalize this for the unoriented, right, that's right.
Can you say standard model with MSSL here? Because you said you haven't broken
supersymmetry. First of all, I mean, as the SSM, whether it's minimal or not, is again a next issue. Typically, it will not be minimal, but then, as a something. But then again, it's sort of it's a stepwise process, clearly.
In that theory, which quantities you know? You said something about not knowing the Keeler potential.
Right. So the quantities that you know is the field content, and you know the superpotential. Those are the quantities that you have complete control over, essentially. And the Keeler potential, indeed, is you don't have control over that, but you keep your fingers crossed that it doesn't do something too weird. So the superpotential is governed by the complex structure of the singularity. So these are all holomorphic data that one can then reconstruct. In the case of the standard model, of course, the superpotential data are essentially related to the Yukawa couplings. And also the mu terms, but it's mostly the Yukawa couplings that will actually rather naturally be tunable from the point of view of these quiver theories. Yes?
The standard model has whatever, 19 parameters. What does your singularity have? Precisely 19 parameters? Is that more? Is that less?
It's an interesting question.
Okay. Do you have 125 parameters that you can tune in, or do you have?
Most of those come from the soft masses and not from the super. So if I don't break supersymmetry yet, then I'm in the right ballpark.
There's functions for so.
Yeah. No, I told you I have 11 cycles. And each of them, at least, is sort of roughly two. Depends on how. So there's a gauge coupling for each cycle, whatever.
You haven't counted whether you can tune them all or not.
Not quite yet, but.
Sean, if you're just doing a construction of fluxes, as opposed to the fluxes, two of the parameters, whatever you use.
Well, my question was whether there are enough complex structure parameters at the singularity.
But that's exactly the point. It's not just complex structure singularities. You can have complex structure counting. You can also add fluxes that would sort of take you away from the just Calabi algorithm, and that, in some sense, pins up all the other couplings that are in the
same. But those are, so you mean discrete fluxes, though? So
no, these are continuous fluxes because they're related to non-compact cycles, so they're
right. Another thing that turns out to be necessary, if you really want to scan all the possible values of the superpotential, turns out that you actually have to make the Del-Petzl surface non-commutative. There's one non-commutativity parameter you have to introduce. So you have to generalize the notion of complex structure a little bit. But that's all part of the game, in principle. It turns out that, and this is not for a particular reason, that, and I just want to sort of get cut to the chase, although in principle, this is a rather generic framework where you could, general framework where you could try to just take your favorite Calabi-Yau singularity, take your favorite set of brains on it, or at least you make a list. You can put it on a computer probably. And then there's one other thing in the end that you want to do is that you can recognize gauge theories, and most typically the gauge theories that you'll get obviously will not be the standard model, that would be a bit strange, but then you want to find theories that can, for example, contain the standard model as a rather natural symmetry breaking. And symmetry breaking, I'll say a few words about that, in this case corresponds to a particular deformation of your singularity. But for practical purposes, and it also was the starting point of Dave's paper with his David Wierenstein's paper with his collaborators, we just take a single D3 brain. And it's kind of surprising how far one can get just by thinking about a single D3 brain on a Calabi-Yau singularity. It turns out that basically you can get the full, content of the standard model, three generations of quarks with precisely the right quantum numbers, SU3, SU2. And one of the things that I'll be explaining, which one has to do a little bit more work for, is that indeed one can have the right hypercharge assignments as well for all the particles. And all the Yukawa couplings also are possible, and you don't need to work hard in order to get them in this case because they're tunable by the shape of the surface. The only extra ingredient that this construction has is indeed an abundance of Higgs fields, namely basically a pair of Higgs fields or two pairs of Higgs fields per generation, which is somewhat excessive. On the other hand, it's not that unnatural to have a Higgs field per generation. And again, it's somewhat surprising that you can do that with a single brain, because then you can really say that all the matter basically comes from the curvature rather than from doing something complicated with the brains. And why is so? People at this point could be confused. I was talking about these guys as being some complicated set of ingredients that can intersect. How can a single D3 brain intersect with itself? It can do it. And the way it can do it is by, if I call these things the charge vectors of F, S, it's a bunch of numbers. Basically, what happens is the following. This is quite miraculous. You take a single D3 brain, you put it on a Calabi-Yau singularity, it will fractionate in brains, which is not entirely surprising if you think about the Calabi-Yau singularity as perhaps a limit of a or a generalization of an orbifold. It just sees its mirror images. Basically, it can see itself many times, and each of those images essentially become one of the fractional brains in such a combination that the multiplicity of each brain, when you add them up, will just give me the charge vector of a single D3 brain. Again, this is a specific restriction, and here for sure there's no guarantee why one would start with this particular point, but if you don't see a specific reason for not starting with a simple starting point, just start with a simple starting point. So that's what we're doing here. And this will uniquely fix those multiplicities, and the reason is, of course, that this thing is a complete orthogonal basis of the cohomology. This is one particular point in the cohomology, a vector in the cohomology of the base, and this has a unique set of numbers. And then once you know the multiplicities and you know the intersection numbers, you get your quiver. Now it turns out that indeed for Delpezzo 8, there's a type of quiver diagram that results from doing this particular game. That seems rather promising in getting the standard model. I will not describe this construction. You can find it in my paper with Weinhold from last year. I'll actually describe more when I talk about the hypercharge, where I want to get to the paper with Dave and two students, Matt Bork and Dmitry Malyshev. So I want to move on here and basically just say the following, is that, okay, one can take a particular gauge theory just based on a single D brain on the Delpezzo surface. You have to do something with that gauge theory in order to get the standard model. And to outline what one needs to do, let me draw another picture, which is essentially a picture of the topology of the Delpezzo surface. This is an E8 Dinkin diagram, which encodes the information of the Cartan matrix of E8. And the Cartan matrix of E8 is a bunch of integers, and those integers are the intersection numbers between various cycles. So I have these two cycles, and those two cycles within the four manifold, the base X, intersect, and that intersection basis, intersection matrix, is the Cartan matrix of E8 for the Delpezzo 8 surface. This observation is of use for many other applications of Delpezzo surfaces. In our case, we use it somewhat differently than most other applications, because this E8 will have nothing to do with our gauge group. But it turns out that if you start with the Delpezzo 8 surface, you get this particular larger theory, which has quite a few gauge groups, but you want to do a symmetry breaking of that original gauge theory in order to get the standard model. And the way one interprets that symmetry breaking, in our case, what we need is we need to do something special with two cycles. Basically, I'm going to throw away two of the cycles within the Delpezzo surface, which are alpha 1 and alpha 2, the two cycles associated with the first two roots of E8. And that will form, for the experts, an A2 singularity. And again, also in one of the papers, early papers of Dave Morrison, it was explained how in generic geometric engineering constructions, if you have brains and there's a two singularity around, that may open up a new branch in the gauge theory moduli space. Essentially what this does, it puts certain terms in the superpotential equal to zero so that you can turn off on certain expectation values, do the symmetry breaking, and in the brain language, that would amount to essentially removing these fractional brains or essentially reassembling them in bound states that only wrap those remaining cycles. And it turns out that if you still take the same rule as here, so my basis now has become smaller. I've gotten rid of a few, these two over here. And then if you still take the single D3 brain on that other special geometry, you get a gauge theory that is not quite the standard model, but it starts to look close. So this is you too. The gauge theory you get looks like this. Obviously, you expect a strongly interacting gauge group SU3. Now, this particular node I'll say a little bit more about. So this is my sort of naive picture of the standard model. This one is an extra U1, which is essentially the lepton number, because these lines are going to be leptons. Each of these lines actually occurs three times in this construction, so indeed we get exactly three generations, which, by the way, is one of the most restrictive requirements when you sort of go through the list. It's quite easy often to make a standard model with one or two generation. It's much harder often to make it with three generations.
So where's the three?
The three just comes from computing some intersection number between these brains.
And something you did to the del Pazzo above the NRX?
No, to be honest, again, it was also the starting point of the earlier constructions. But once you look at this particular quiver that comes from this geometry, you already recognize that the original quiver from the del Pazzo 8 geometry had three generations, essentially. It had three lines here.
I think there were some unrealistic examples, like the SE3 cube or whatever, which has three generations because of the three extra complex divisions.
Yeah, is there a geometric explanation of it? At this point, I would just say, well, these things are intersect each other three times. Obviously, in three complex dimensions, one can intersect also less than three times or more than three times. So I don't think there's any more specific connection to that. So anyway, there's three generations of these guys, three generations of those guys.
I mean, if your goal was to survey all the possible quivers that could arise by that, so you would see a wide variety of things. And it's really nice that when you look through that list, this kind of pops out at you, right? It's the one that we live in.
Yeah. By the way, we didn't scan 10 to the 14 vacua. This was obtained by scanning maybe 20.
I wouldn't say it's independent, but when you put in all the variations, you get a whole bunch of different apples. It's not completely clear what the input output relationships
are. Kevin, can you explain why intersection is related to number of generations?
Because essentially these guys over here, which are the bifundamentals, are the strings that stretch between one brain and the other brain, okay. And they're only light if the brains intersect.
So are you saying that all the custom... I think that all the couplings are here, including the mu term.
No, the mu term is not there, and that's actually sort of, if I get to it, that's over here. The mu term, we have to do a little bit of work.
Is X like many nodes, or is X?
Yeah, no, I call it X. X indeed is U1 to some number. In this case, it's 6. Basically means that every electron, the electron, the muon, and the tau, and the three neutrinos each have their own node. So each of them have their own node. So this line is actually a single line. This happens to be two lines. This is a single line. But since this thing has actually six nodes, you can make all the spurious U1s are going to go away. They look ugly now, but we actually have a rather generic and a rather nice way of immediately getting rid of them. And actually, generically, they would go away in a string compactification, but you actually have to work to keep the hypercharge. So that's what I want to explain now. So essentially, again, to me, by the way, these quiver diagrams are extremely useful, at least if I don't understand the standard model, if I want to know why there's no mu term here, basically because they're charged relative to some nodes over here, if I want to know why I need R parity in order to prevent an L-H coupling. In this case, I don't need essentially R parity because this node will separate it. I cannot write down the thing that I want to throw out by R parity, so there's something good about that here. But anyway, this is actually a rather useful representation of the standard model, but it has all these extra ugly U1s, but they are all going to go away and just collapse into hypercharge, provided one does the appropriate thing, and that's explained in the paper with Dave and
other people. Can you just go over that one more time? The three twos are the ones that go from the trips V3 to V2. The left-hand doublets are the ones that are there.
Between the U1 and the U2 over here?
The Higgs doublets are
where? These are the Higgses. And they separate out actually eventually into, I should actually separate this out in two nodes, because hypercharge, it's actually six nodes, but they naturally are split into two groups because hypercharge will distinguish these two, because indeed these lines are both the electrons and the neutron and the neutrinos, and therefore indeed their charges are different over here.
These are right-handed.
These are the right-handed neutrinos.
There's,
right.
There's six three bar states there.
The U and the D. So all the particles just appear once.
How do I say six with one arrow?
Yeah, because this is a U1 to the 6. I didn't want to draw six nodes here. There's a U1 to the 6. So these are six lines. These are six lines.
Okay.
So everything, every matter particle only has one line, and there's only one line for each. Okay, wait. That's a unique. A nice thing, by the way, about this construction with these specific fractional brains that mathematicians give us is that the lines here don't return between two nodes. Every it's sort of maximally chiral. You only need lines in one direction, and I sort of feel safe for it because that actually means that this thing is a rather stable configuration. You can another thing that this configuration has, which most brains on toroidal string compactifications don't have, is that there are no adjoints. So all the brains are on rigid cycles. They don't move. You don't need to worry about the moduli of the brain. I didn't hide any feature of my field theory. This is the complete field theory on the brain.
That's actually a little confusing, because a single three brain you think could just move away.
Yeah, that single three brain is actually a very uninteresting feature of this theory, which is the overall U1.
Oh, yeah.
And there's nothing charged under it.
Do you have lots of extra standard model singlets around?
No.
No. Look, right down the
trails. Yeah, right. At this point, they will become standard model singlets. But right now, they're still charged under various of the U1s.
But you don't have any singlet like to give a right-handed neutrino a mass in a super.
Right. There's no easy way of pairing, of writing down a Majorana. I do have a right-handed neutrino,
yeah.
But its mass actually is a pure Dirac mass in this case.
I'm just confused about this U1 because generally all these U1s would be global, even though they go away from the gauge theory. Right? It is a global U1.
And why do you say they're global U1s?
Well, because even though they are anomalous, so the gauge coupling can't.
No, let me briefly back up there. So among these U1s, there are two anomalous U1s, and there's six, seven, whatever, some number of non-anomalous U1s.
So that's what it means. Because okay, so the standard model has only three U1s altogether, right? I mean, one is gauge, and two others.
Right.
So what happens to all the others?
Let me explain what happens to all the others. So generically, if you have a brain, so obviously when we made this thing, at some point you thought, well, okay, how do we get rid of the U1s? And then for a moment you actually think, hey, how do I keep any of the U1s? Because basically what happens in string theory is that as soon as you put this thing in a compact Calabi-Yau, and now I'm including, again, some extra ingredient that's not part of this cone-like geometry, but if there's a compact Calabi-Yau, then there are extra fields in the story that we need have to worry about, which initially was already clear because of the anomalous U1s, that indeed there's the Green-Schwarz type anomaly cancellation, which involves two couplings. There's some C2 coupling to a trace F wedge F, which becomes sort of an axionic field that can cancel the U1 anomalies. But an important coupling is this one as well. And it's basically this particular coupling which is also there for the non-anomalous U1s. And what will happen...
These are different U2s.
They may be different, or they're actually sort of dual. If you want to cancel the Green-Schwarz anomaly, exactly you need that there's a propagator between these two. Because for canceling the U1 anomalies, you need both this vertex and that vertex. That actually led to a lot of sort of confusion, because typically people say that only the anomalous U1s, non-anomalous U1s become massive, but it's also the non-anomalous U1s that become massive because of that term.
The bottom one is phi times F, which F, where phi is
a scalar.
Dual.
You're actually right. But let's ignore this particular guy here. Let's focus on this thing. This is a 3 plus 1 dimensional term in the 3 plus 1 dimensional volume of the brain. So typically what this C2 actually is in our brains, it's the Kaluza-Klein reduction from some field in 10 dimension. And if this is a 7 brain, then there's the 6 form, which you have to reduce over a 4 cycle in order to get the 2 form. And there are 5 brains, etc. So this is some linear combination of Ramon and Moore forms that will couple to a particular fractional brain. But the key thing about this is that if that particular... mode is normalizable on the Calabi-Yau manifold, then this will descend to a particular 3 plus 1 dimensional action for that 2 form field. This is the Kaluza-Klein reduction. And if there's a normalizable kinetic term for the Ramon-Moore field, it will actually turn the gauge field into a massive gauge field. So typically any U1 theory that's a gauge boson that's associated with the brain, if it couples to a normalizable Ramon-Moore mode, it will become massive via this particular mechanism.
Can you see that from the knowledge point of view? Is there a way, usually from the anomalous U1, it's clear how to know that they become massive. How do you know that?
So that's actually one of the surprises that to me was there here as well. Is normally I would have thought that sort of the philosophy is that the lowest energy physics is all determined locally near the Calabi-Yau singularity, but it turns out that which U1 is massless actually is determined by more information than just the local geometry. So how the Calabi-Yau singularity is embedded within the Calabi-Yau will actually matter, because it's that particular embedding that will determine which modes are normalizable. There's a notion called, I'm sure, again, this was explained by Joe, relative cohomology, that tells you when you have a cohomology within, that's part of your singularity. So this thing may have some cohomology, and there's, if I embed it in some Calabi-Yau, then that full Calabi-Yau may have certain cohomology, and then you can write down, I'm sure there was on the blackboard, an exact sequence that will tell you which part of the Calabi-Yau cohomology will actually overlap with the cohomology of the surface. And roughly speaking, and just in simplistic terms, you could do the following. Suppose I take harmonic forms on my Calabi-Yau, call them omega alpha. If I shouldn't call them omega alpha. Give me another Greek name. Because I have a two-cycle over here, which I called alpha. And if I can take, so let me give this a sub-index A. I can make a matrix PAI, which is the integral of some form, a harmonic two-form on my Calabi-Yau manifold here over this cycle alpha A, and it will turn out that this matrix is not necessarily invertible. There are certain, there could be particular cycles within the Calabi-Yau, within the base here, within X, that are trivial within Y. And then this particular integral for such a specific cycle alpha A would actually be zero. Which means that the corresponding brain wrapping number around this cycle, if there's a corresponding U1 associated with it, will not have a corresponding Stukeberg field. And therefore, that particular U1 would remain massless.
Does this work the other direction, where you could actually say, look at the various hypercharges you could assign, and maybe that would actually tell you something about the unique completion of the that particular singularity?
Right. Are you saying, well, I could have chosen a different definition of what hypercharge is?
Yeah.
Right.
If you look at all the possible definitions of hypercharge, does that actually give you any information about the completion?
That's precisely what one can do, because basically you take a given hypercharge, and I erase this thing, but there's this labeling of the two cycles, and it turns out that basically every extra U1 that I have here, those things are crossed out. But every of those nodes of every two cycle is associated with a non-anomalous U1. And now hypercharge is actually a pretty complicated linear combination of these U1s. And one of the nice things about this particular geometric setup is that there's a nice two cycle that's associated with hypercharge. If I take the linear combination of fractional brains that gives me hypercharge, it's this particular cycle, the alpha 4 cycle, that is associated with hypercharge. Just happens to be the case.
Herman, it's one to the left. Alpha 3 was up on top, alpha 4 is.
No, I think this is. This is the alpha 8. I'm sure I'm doing something unconventional here. Which for me, that's alpha. Okay. It's this one. It's this guy.
Herman, another question?
Yes.
Does that mean that the charge that you associated with brains dropping off before is not really a charge in the full theory?
Yes.
So that brain can, in principle, just disappear.
Right. I'll tell you something about it. That's where this comes.
But don't these C2s get masses in flux-compact occasions? I mean, they won't be there in H2.
Which gets masses?
I mean, if you stabilize the moduli, these will be massive.
Right. Okay, let me that's this thing.
Okay. If you want to put it in a compact space, you need probably some oriented loads, and how do you...
Right, so now the orient fault is a special way of doing it, because it's the most general compactification that you could put this in is an F-theory compactification. But again, in accord with the philosophy that I'm sort of advocating here, this bottom-up philosophy, I don't want to say too much specific about the compactification. I only want to keep the information that I actually need. And the information, indeed, that I need is that this particular cycle is indeed contractible, and all the other ones are actually really part of the cohomology of the Clavijo-Menu fold, because I know that those other ones become massive. So that's this piece of information, and actually, Dave clearly explained a construction of how to embed a Clavijo singularity within a local Clavijo region without actually telling you too much about the full geometry, but what is the topology where it's already obvious which cycles are really part of the cohomology and which one is trivial. So that's in the paper, and you can read it, and it's a beautiful construction that's very generic, which essentially tells you how to do that particular embedding. So now let me get to the two last points, both of which have been questions about. One is, these things get masses, and what to do with all those U1s? Those things are connected. That's where the d-incitons come in, and there's a very interesting thing that's connected with the monopoles. Yeah, I'll say that's connected with that. Because mu terms are actually forbidden by the U1s. So what will happen via these mechanisms is that all these U1s become massive. They get a mass of order the string scale, and therefore, whatever, they turn into global U1s. But we know that in full string compactifications, there are no such thing as global U1s. So what breaks the U1 symmetries? Now, there things get rather concrete, is that what you do is you have a particular field here. In order to understand that this thing becomes a mass term, you dualize it in four dimensions. You go to dual scalar field. How should I say? It depends. You can still manipulate it by doing various crazy things with various cycles. Typically, it will be string scale. So I can push it up to any scale that I want. Now, for each of the U1s that becomes massive, there's a corresponding Stuckey-Barre field. These things are called Stuckey-Barre fields that are the longitudinal mode of that particular gauge field. And that massive gauge field, and that thing shifts under the U1 rotations that are the U1 gauge symmetry. But now, suppose I would essentially include a KKLT type contribution to the superpotential coming from wrapping the three brains, Euclidean, the three brains, which are actually four-dimensional within the Calabi-Yau, around particular two cycles, because what this guy turns out to be, it turns out to be the four-form integrated around some cycle B alpha, where B alpha is dual, so it intersects. I chose alpha, right? Did I? It intersects alpha I. So there's a two-cycle whose U1 gets lifted. Then there's a dual four-cycle within the Calabi-Yau. That thing extends all the way towards the UV region of the Calabi-Yau. And if I take the C4 field integrated over that particular guy, I get the thing that sits here. Now, if I would look at the d-instanton action of a brain that wraps that particular cycle, that d-instanton contribution will be charged because it will contain an e to the I rho I. And therefore, the global U1s will get broken by that particular d-instanton type contribution. Then, indeed, there's going to be some moduli stabilization mechanism that will give a mass to those rho I's, which means that those things are no longer... Okay, now I'm actually sometimes getting confused a bit about this, but anyway, that thing I can sort of throw it out of my description, and then the effective term that comes from the D instanton, so this is the punchline, and you can think about it yourself. The D instanton that wraps a particular four cycle will give it a contribution that breaks the corresponding global U1. So there's a rather clean mechanism of breaking the global U1s via these d-instanton contributions. And coming back to the mu terms are terms indeed that break the global U1s, and the basic idea is that the mu terms should get generated by these d-instanton effects. That's a good bet, which is actually nice because mu terms are very small from the string scale perspective, and d-instantons can be made very, contributions can be made very small from a string scale perspective.
About the low energy, I mean, but again, for the anomalous ones, I can understand that there's an anomaly, and then I know that things are going to generate, but I can't see that on the
These things are not instantons that exist in the gauge theory. They're not field theory ones. They're actually even less field theoretic than the ones that were considered by in the paper, a recent paper with Shamit and collaborators. I think Natalia will talk about that tomorrow. These are brains that wrap the singularity. Those you would expect are field theoretic ones, but actually it doesn't even always materialize as such.
Field theories generally don't exist because they have non-asymptotic.
All right. But the brains that do, these brains actually do that. These D instantons do that. And therefore, you don't see them as purely gauge theory instantons. So they're really stringy corrections, but they are couplings that you can include in the game.
Do the D instantons also violate lepton number?
They will violate lepton number, at least. You have to be careful with what you're going to violate. Clearly, obviously, the one way of making me nervous is to force me to do phenomenology with this. clearly, some things need to be small, and other things need to be less small. That's clearly a game that one can try to play at this level.
So, the size of the new terms will be determined by the
volume of that particular cycle. It will be exponentially tuned by the volume of that cycle.
Yeah, but if you wanted to compute them...
Then you would have to know what that volume of that cycle is, but that's part of my garbage can.
And the prefactor.
So, sorry?
And the prefactor of the exponent.
You would have to compute, indeed, the fluctuation determinant of the d-instantons, which probably will depend on certain topological data or what kind of cycle that thing wraps. Again, that's a delicate game, which may or not be doable. Okay, let me, yes.
Actually, before you get to monopoles, I'm confused about the stability of the brain wrapping alpha 4 even as a space filling brain.
Right, okay. So I'll draw the picture. If you go to my computer, get the figure of my computer, which I was making, then that figure would explain most of that stuff. So let's finally get to both the stability issue of the brain and the monopoles. So, okay, here's my artist rendition of the situation. So this is a two-cycle here. This is my alpha, which is some two-cycle that sits at some cone, and this is my Calabi-Yau over here. So this is my Calabi-Yau, okay? Now, the two-cycle alpha is wrapped by a Defy brain, and that Defy brain carries... Actually, it's not quite wrapped by a Defy brain. It's wrapped by... There are many more cycles here. There are bound states. A linear combination of the bound states wraps this cycle alpha. That cycle is contractible within the... is trivial within the Calabi-Yau, which means there's a three-chain gamma whose boundary... So it's a three-dimensional submanifold within the Calabi-Yau, whose boundary is this alpha, and that's the thing that's worrying you, because this guy might sort of unwrap. But first of all, this alpha is a cycle within a singularity, so it's very small. So there's a tunneling thing. The tunneling amplitude, basically, it goes with the volume of this gamma to the fourth power divided by the volume of this alpha to the cubed power. And there's a 1 over GS here somewhere and string tensions, and you know the two pi's that go in there. And it's the minus this. So if this ratio is small enough, that tunneling amplitude will be small. But there's now a rather natural question one can ask once you have this particular setup, is what we've been talking briefly about the D-instantons, and we talked about space-filling brains, but there's an intermediate dimensionality of the brains. And there's a very interesting situation one can consider. Because what I've shown you, if you have a brain construction and you want to have a massless U1, you better have one of these trivial cycles in the game, which means that there's such a chain. Now, there's an immediate consequence of that, is that I can actually take a D3 brain that wraps that particular cycle. And now the question is, what is that D3 brain? That D3 brain, indeed, first of all, what is its mass? That's determined by the volume of that cycle, which can be go over a wide range of things. It turns out, that thing is a monopole charged under hypercharge. So hypercharge had to be massless, and this is a hypercharged monopole, which actually you can have a very nice geometric picture of what that thing represents. If I take the phi brain that wraps alpha, so if this is my phi brain that wraps the cycle alpha, suppose this is the radial coordinate on my phi brain world volume, and I have some magnetic flux going through the S2 all the way out to infinity. Now I'm going to shrink my S2, and at some point, where does the flux go? Basically, what happens is that while I go closer to the origin of my five-dimensional brain world volume, this component of the brain will actually start unwrapping over here, whereas this thing actually sort of will move along. So here, you can think about it as moving along with it. But there's a close topology of a D5 brain, which has no boundary, that is somehow wrapping this gamma cycle and also wrapping our space-time. And in that topology, there's going to be a source for a magnetic monopole at the middle. So this is a sort of an interesting example of a prediction, at least topologically, from this kind of setup. And this may actually be a distinction between this particular construction and sort of undermining my earlier philosophy that this is sort of a generic setup. This might be sort of a distinctive feature of it, where there are these type of monopoles. And the interesting part about this type of monopole is actually that it's not associated with any enhanced gauge symmetry, any non-abelian gauge symmetry in the low-energy field theory. So it's a monopole that purely exists on an abelian brain, because the abelian brain can actually unwrap here. I should mention a paper by Dave Kumaranvafa and Brian Green, which got the other name, which is a geometric realization of confinement, but what had an earlier name in which was called brains on chains. This is a brain that wraps a chain within the Calabi-Yau manifold, and it leads to a monopole in our 3+1 dimensions. By the way, the fact that it's a hypercharged monopole is actually sort of interesting. There's interesting physics associated with it, because the question is, what does a hypercharged monopole do? Because hypercharge is not a massless boson. So is a hypercharged monopole a real monopole, or does it have a string attached to it? Any guess? It may have a it may actually have a string attached to it, but the minimal energy configuration is actually one where it purely transforms into a rotationally symmetric magnetic monopole, because the standard model without hypercharged monopoles actually has a confined monopole, which is the SU2 monopole. That confined monopole has a Z string, basically a Z flux string attached to it, and it has magnetic charge. And if I take that particularly confined monopole in the regular standard model and combine it with this hypercharged monopole, I get an ordinary electromagnetic monopole. No, so they're always monopoles in the following sense, that if I have some brain here and I would have some other brain somewhere sitting over here, I can always sort of have some brain that wraps between, I can have these strings, say, that go between this brain and that brain. But secretly speaking, these are sort of still coming from some symmetry breaking, although that's stretching things maybe a little bit, in the sense that this is the stack of this is the basic example where I have two brains separated by a string, which is basically just SU2 gauge theory broken via an adjoint.
Right.
This case, actually, since the other brain is not there, but there's actually this thing here, it's a pure Born-Infeld phenomenon. One can actually understand it in the effective field in the Born-Infeld.
But I mean, if you ever find an exact U1 in string theory, you know there's going to be a monopole somehow, just because there has to be. you know the bullshit argument. There could be a black hole that which the can contain a magnetic charge at worst.
Okay.
But you know, so if there's ever gravity around, you're going to have monopoles associated with any U1. And the question is there some low energy gauge theory that makes it easier to see, like some great unified monopole? Now, so it's just a question of whether it's up at string or Planck scale or less.
Right. Now, in this case, that depends on the size of the cycle, right, which is sort of tunable. But so what you're telling me is I should have found that thing, otherwise I would probably have had trouble.
That's right.
Okay.
There's a lot of possibility that there are U1s that have no monopole.
How can
the theory of gravity? Yeah, because we don't know that black holes exist at every possible charge. I mean, if we always admit the limit where a black hole will turn into a ternary object, then we can. There's not a guarantee that you can make a monopole and then charge it. They have to.
Even a large monopole? I mean, a large macroscopic monopole?
Yeah.
But I mean just on low energy field theory?
Okay, so suppose that you didn't have a non-black objects, a monopole. Then it's possible that it's a black hole which has smaller charge because there's no monopole to forbid it. Or a black hole with a monopole. You don't know which it is a priori. There's no rule.
The monopole could be unstable.
It could be a black hole with continuous values of charge, no charge quantization, no monopoles. I think this real question is whether, I mean, it's true in every example, but it often involves subtle topological issues like this to find the charge. I think it's an interesting example. I don't think you can just, need three black holes saturated.
Another argument is that just because you have a U1, you can't put magnetic charge on a black hole unless you have non-trivial topology, unless you basically have another asymptotic region, because then you're representing some sort of flux. But if you're forming the black hole from collapsing matter, and your matter doesn't carry any magnetic charges, you're never going to form a magnetic.
But clearly, again, as Joe was saying, there's a difference between having a generic argument and actually exhibiting it as a regular solution. And this is sort of an interesting class, although again it's essentially pointed out in the paper by Dave and collaborators, but not quite in the deep brain in the specific context as here. Yes.
Brain wrapping this.
Yeah, so that's one question is this kind of tunneling process one way of generating a small supersymmetry breaking in the whole game?
What's the sort of scales? There should be a natural scale here.
Maybe it's really true with the quiver locus. Somehow you restore supersymmetry and the thing's exactly stable.
In the limit, this is sort of confirms it. In the limit where, because basically the alpha has to sort of shrink to zero, strictly zero size. And then this thing becomes not.
But then you're saying it really doesn't have supersymmetric configuration. It's really not stable.
You're saying that
it, yeah, right. So strict. So who knows? At least.
Only get the initial one you played, so there will be some highly relevant doesn't have supersymmetric. Yeah. Yeah. So
the question is whether the knowledge, whether this particular quote unquote meta stability will translate itself. And actually, at some level, it's true, right? That there are small deformations in the geometry of the singularity that sort of penetrate from the knowledge of having this particular cycle. It's not entirely strictly conical. It's not there may indeed be geometric features of that singularity. That might obstruct.
My guess would have been that the effects of the Suzy breaking will be small if that cycle is large, but then, for example, the monopoles are so heavy.
No, what are the monopoles? Well, is that
there's some mass of the monopoles that depends on the size of that cycle.
That's right. But that's in accord.
The size of the Suzy breaking also goes inversely with the size of the cycle.
Yeah, but this thing becomes heavy, and this thing, this at least. This is the Suzy breaking will probably be suppressed by this tunneling amplitude.
But even apart from the standard model, you're showing us an interesting way to make metastable states. Do you know what kind of breaking it is?
Isn't it sort of what you?
Is it
not entirely what you did? Also, isn't that your calculation where you? Although that's like the anti-brain sort of going away.
It's kind of
strange. In this case, again, it's a brain tunneling. But it's an interesting. It's certainly a very. It's worth revisiting this kind of setup, especially since at least in any brain scenario, if you want to have massless U1s, you generically end up with that kind of situation. It's a rather generic situation.
Is there anything you can say about Yukawa couplings?
Again, the Yukawa couplings, they're determined in terms of the shape. So in principle, once you write down, and the Apesta service has an equation. If I know the equation, not me, someone else can do the calculation. And compute the Yukawa couplings for you. So the equation determines the Yukawa couplings. So suppose there are certain Yukawa couplings you want to make very small that might determine certain a tuning in the shape of that particular Dopetzel surface. So this was sort of my hope at some point is that by doing that translation, there's a direct shape of the standard model of coupling up.
All your mu terms are one of the weak scale, is that right? I mean, you have lots of mu terms.
I have lots of mu terms, but they're governed by the size of that dual cycle, so they're tunable by some data that are not directly. So the mu terms indeed are distinct from the Yukawa couplings. The Yukawa couplings are from tuned by local geometry, but the mu terms are actually come from the UV. Which is sort of good in the sense that would explain why they're naturally small. Although I'm sure that if there had been mu terms here, I would probably have said, well, okay, well.
So the question is, are they all well the weak scale if you make them very large? I didn't
understand. Yeah, I have exponential tunability. So because they depend on volumes of cycles, some cycle might be large compared to the string scale, another cycle might be small compared to the string scale. In one case, it leads to a highly suppressed, exponentially suppressed mu term, another mu term can be. That's an interesting game because I want to make some mu terms large because then I can supersymmetrically get rid of my Higgs fields.
What about the baryon number?
What about baryon number? So there's a U on B minus L in this particular game, and clearly.
And
there's a U1B and there's a U1L, and U1B minus L is the non-anomalous combination, at least of the two. And the question is, how is that going to be broken? Well, you better suppress that sufficiently in order to.
Monopoles would be useful.
By the way, these are not grand unified monopoles, so they will not catalyze baryon decay.
But they don't carry if you integrate them into a little hypercharge.
Well, it might catalyze stringy baryon decay. And if it's an anomaly, for baryon number alpha stringy.
All right. Okay, fine. Okay. There are lots of questions. Certainly, as soon as you introduce pulmonology in the game, I'm.
and you say you have an R parity in this?
I have a U1B minus L, I don't need R parity at this level. R parity will come about once I break the U minus L. Maybe there's some discrete. There's at least I'll have to worry about that after breaking the U1B minus L.
But the left out of the air.
I mean, despite your comment, I mean, is there any, I mean, getting back to phenomenology, would you ever want that cycle gamma to be small?
Obviously, I want to push it as small as I can.
For what reason?
To be able to say that if you would build the next generation after LHC, you might see them. No.
Is there any reason why gamma should be small?
No. The size of gamma, actually, the size of gamma doesn't...
Your parameters be large enough for them not to show up at LHC.
Okay, so wait a minute. So new parameter is large as gamma...
Yeah.
Small.
No.
Large.
By the way, gamma is a three... No, no. Wait. Gamma is a three cycle, and the other guys are four cycles. So the new parameters are determined by certain four cycles, and this guy is a different... doesn't enter into the mu parameters.
So you just want to suppress the wrappings of the gamma cycle?
My guess is if I want to push, I want to apply the philosophy of trying to put the interesting physics as low as possible, then my rough guess is that the monopole that you would get in this way, you would probably put it around 100 TeV, or maybe at least by pushing the string scale low, making that cycle small. No, actually, the thing, this is a pretty high suppression. If this cycle gamma in string units is a factor of 5 bigger than the size of that particular cycle, which indeed is very small. Basically has to be zero in order, otherwise you get FI parameters that sort of are not there. You can make this thing highly suppressed even without making that thing.
It has to be finite because that's what controls the coupling of hypercharge, right?
I'm sorry?
This thing. Essential hypercharge is controlled by volume of alpha, so that's fixed by low energy data.
Yeah, but anyway, that particular guy, I suspect that it's fine. What's your string scale in your model?
Oh, the one of today?
Yeah, yesterday.
it's about 5 TeV.
5 TeV. So I would say, one over G string times the volume of that cycle, which could be 5, so a factor of 100 times higher than your string scale, I think that would be the mass of my monopole. Because in your particular model, you also have one of these cycles.
Is that like m string over alpha? I mean, alpha strong.
Yeah, one string, one m string over alpha. I think that's roughly where it will be. Plus maybe some factor of 5 to make this thing e to the minus 100 or something. Because if this 5 to the 4th, that might do it in terms of suppressing the tunneling rate.
I have another more math question. So in stupid orbitals like C3 and LHC3, where you have three.
Right. So you start with something that looks already very close, right?
So in those models, for example, the flavor symmetry there is just geometric. It's like the some residual rotation group of the.
Oh.
Is there some similar sort of geometric understanding of what flavor symmetry means here?
Yeah, flavor symmetry, at least in terms of permuting these nodes, these lines.
Those,
yeah. Those lines probably can be permuted as well by just some.
I'm sure
the modelized space of Delpezzo surfaces has some Z3 from the whatever acting on it that interchanges those guys.
That's just discrete.
I don't think there's a continuous one. There's.
But I'm sort of trying to get a sense of what might I add to it in terms of data from the Fabiano flavor symmetry. In the
C3 case,
would be something with this.
It's not answering your question, but the main difference between this approach and Z3 mod Z3 starting point is that in that case, indeed, the Z3 mod Z3 does most of it what you want, but then they actually need to add one non-compact 7 brain.
I'm not indicating it as a model of monology. I'm saying there that just sort of certain flavor like symmetries have an obvious
right.
Yeah, no, but I think Herman's right that you could see, the bow group of some continuous symmetry as the residue of the
right.
Been there. Okay. But directly in the Delpezzo, you're not going to see.
It is true that here the origin of flavor is just a fine tune, right? You have three U Powell couplings which a priori
okay.
For the electron muon and tau.
Yeah, but there could be a discrete symmetry that caused that resistance. In other words, if there was some reason,
you want them to look different, not the same.
No, wait.
No, yeah, for the non-supersymmetric theory, but there's the supersymmetric.
No, I know. I was just talking about the
so you got a 6x6 mu matrix.
Yeah.
But that thing, I basically I could if I have my muse and I could raise the scale of the muse, I get rid of most of these these things. Or if I can want to exploit them, I'll exploit them. But if I want to push this further.
That's quite big, this space of possibilities that you have at this stage.
It's at least at this point, unless someone has a killer argument that could throw this in the waste basket. I think actually right now this thing is still alive. That's to me that's actually remarkable in the sense that
you can't say one pair of pig stubbles actually couples to one family of quarks and leptons, and there's another pair of quarks a different family in the structure of the material.
You mean the Higgs? So in principle, they couple individually to the different generations of right-handed quarks.
Each one can couple to everybody.
Each one can only couple to the right-handed quark. But it can happen a couple to any left-handed quark. Mm-hmm. So.
So it means that your light Higgs has to be some linear combination of all.
Right, it has some linear combination, which is fine. At least there's some mass matrix that will make some of them massive, and there's some combination of them that will just call the light Higgs. And that's the thing that would survive.
So your mu matrix, you may want to have something like determinant of mu matrix equal close to zero, so that everybody else gets large in one linear combination of light.
Clearly it's an interesting game. Once I would give myself the full mu matrix here, for sure I can push this thing much closer to reality than that. But since right now we're just at the point where we have identified a mechanism for generating them, the two things one can try to do, either just compute them, which I don't think is going to be a very useful thing. I think basically you assume that you can make them, and then you see how to use them.
So if you wanted to push the piano as slow as you could, essentially, wouldn't you run into problems first with the extra ones, the bosons that you get from there, screwing up electrode data before that you could observe the actual monopole?
No, again, the size, as mentioned earlier as well, the size of this gamma has nothing to do with the size of the cycles that give me U1 violations. Because those are four cycles and this is a three chain. So I could, I'm not sure if this Kolmogorov can bend itself really in all the shapes that we are now asking it to do, but fine.
The Lamarr axions, which are mixing with engaged fields, still are far more, or live in the bulk, or?
They live in this bulk here, so this particular kinetic term is integrated over the full Kolmogorov.
Then you don't generate pi post term if space is compact. Don't generate pi post term for
Generally one does, but those are the ones that are massive and are going to be lifted. I'm not sure what those FI terms would precisely do. I think the one that indeed you want to be most careful with is precisely the one that would give a mass to hypercharged FI terms, because you don't want to generate those. And those seem to be precisely protected by the same mechanism. So the idea is that there's the shape, and then there's the size moduli of the various cycles. The size moduli would then manipulate the FI parameters of the gauge theory. You mean remove? You mean the complex partner? The complex partner of the FI term, or what do you mean?
I'm worried about just killing the D-term potential.
He's saying some open string field with charge under the U1 will have to condense if there's an FI.
So there's per symmet we need to.
So not only does the Kramer modulus shift, but some open string.
Otherwise, the D-term potential is 1-0.
Right. So something you say something open stringy has to happen in the combination of giving a mass to these U1s.
Only if the U1 is actually a gauge symmetry for the ones that. Yeah.
Right. Okay, that's actually an interesting point. Right now I'm actually sort of assuming that the mechanism of giving the U1s a mass will then naturally be coincide with precisely this kind of
configuration. You only want hypercharge anyway. Right?
But in the end, I want hypercharge to be massless.
Yeah, so obviously he doesn't want an FI term for hypercharge.
I don't want an FI frame for hyperchargers, but for the other, you're asking about the other ones. Yeah. Those things are going to be lifted from my low energy spectrum, so I don't see the FI terms anymore. But it's still interesting to study more precisely what the mechanism is that lifts them. I agree.
So your B minus L is not a gauge symmetry, it's not a massless gauge
symmetry. It starts out as one, but then I'm lifting it precisely by this particular mechanism, because in the end it will be.
You're left over with global D minus L.
I'm left with global D minus L, but that might be broken by the instanton effect. That is generically broken by the instanton effects, but those need to be sufficiently suppressed.
Hey, actually, getting back to this question about the D terms, Amelia's question about the D terms, are there open string modes which are charged only under these U1s that you want to get rid of, or is that?
They're not open string modes. I think the U1s that I want to get rid of forbid certain bilinears like the mu terms. I'm not sure if they're specific. There are a lot of fields that are charged under those U1s, for sure. But it's not. They're also charged under other U1s as well.
Maybe we should wind up and then have people.
Right.
Out.